All over the world, Cameroonians believe we still have the World Cup story. Our Excellency's Roger Miller, at the age of 42, scored at the World Cup 1994. This is the record held by Cameroon. No one can take that record for us, believe it. And this World Cup 2022 in Qatar, we go take that cup.
We go take that cup.
We go take that cup. We go take that cup.
Going behind the scenes of the biggest prize in football, this is World Football in Qatar on the BBC World Service.
Hello, I'm Manny Jasmi. Welcome to the programme. I hope you've been enjoying our extra World Cup pods, another one coming on Friday night. Every team has now played at least one game in the World Cup, and the opening ceremony and Qatar's loss to Ecuador already seems like a distant memory. Since then, we've had impressive wins for France, England and Spain, and the game which will go down in World Cup folklore as Saudi Arabia defeated Argentina 2-1. Saudi Arabia's jubilant King Salman even declared a public holiday on Wednesday. That's the power of football and proof that even if you don't like football, it's very much in your interests for your national team to do as well as they can. The former Scotland international Pat Nevin has now been in Qatar for a week. How's it been so far?
Hello, Manny. It's been really enjoyable. Met a lot of very, very, very nice people here. Everyone is incredibly pleasant all the time. It's not unpleasantly hot. The stadiums, I have to say, whatever the cost was, they are phenomenal stadiums and they're well organised, transport's good. A lot of the things we were warned would go wrong haven't gone wrong yet. So far it's quite well organised.
We heard from the Cameroon fans, very confident Cameroon fans at the top of the programme, but that was really just to make our special guest feel at home. He's the former Cameroon defender and veteran of the 2010 World Cup, Sebastien Bassong. Seb, welcome back to the programme. They were confident, those Cameroonians, but it hasn't been a great start, losing 1-0 to Switzerland on Thursday. In fact, Cameroon haven't won at the World Cup for 20 and a half years. But to be fair, it hasn't exactly been a sparkling start for any of the African teams so far. What's your view of it?
Hi, Manny. Yeah, it's true though. It hasn't been a great start for any African team, but I really focus on the Cameroonian one. You know, I'm not surprised about the hope and, you know, like the happiness about the Cameroonian fans. Impossible is not Cameroonian, but from what I've seen today, yeah, it hasn't been a great start. It could have gone better. It should have gone better. I was expecting a better energy from the team. But hopefully Samuel and Rigo are going to fix that and re-inject what we need to have a better performance in the next game.
You were at the game, weren't you, Pat? Cameroon's defeat to Switzerland. What did you think?
It was a real shame because what I was expecting in the second half, when you lost that early goal in the second half in the Swiss, just shut up shop. You just decided to defend and play in the break, and that's their game, and they're good at it. I expected a wave of, you know, Cameroonian attack, and it just didn't happen. You know, it was real sadness. I have to tell you, do you know the player who had the most outfield energy? I honestly think Onana. It was, wasn't it? He kept on trying to get involved in the play, the goalkeeper, and there was one point he took the ball and he had three of his teammates behind him in midfield, and it's the keeper. You know, he was so desperate to inject the pace, and that was the thing that was maybe the most disappointing thing for Cameroon, that, you know, this game, because you probably won't beat Brazil, this game meant everything, and we just expected a bit more at the end, but, 1-0, and they've got a mountain to climb now.
Before the tournament, Pat, all the talk about Spain was a very good team, very pretty, but couldn't really score. So, naturally, they won 7-0. But how much should we read into that result against Costa Rica, who, I mean, if you thought Iran were poor, Costa Rica made them look like World Cup contenders.
Yeah, it's very difficult to gauge that at the moment. It really is. I mean, they did look nice. They had lots of space. There was no great organisation with the Costa Rican side, and they were a real disappointment because, you know, they've had great results in the past against really good teams. But you can only play what you're playing against, what's up against you. You know, and Pedri and Gavi and Olmo, they all looked very, very good. You can't tell yet. It's too early, but it's a good start for Spain. I thought this tournament would be a tournament too early, maybe for those young Spanish ones, to really push it. But we've known in the past that a young team could sometimes just grow together. And that might still happen for Spain, but we don't know yet, even though they won 7-0.
A feature of the opening week has been the restrictions on European players who have wanted to demonstrate their support for anti-discrimination. The England captain Harry Kane's plan to wear a One Love armband was thwarted by FIFA, who said that he'd get a yellow card if he wore it. The Belgium defender Jan Vertonghen said that players are being controlled by FIFA, and he fears that players will be punished for speaking about racism or discrimination. It's a difficult one, this, guys, isn't it? Although it doesn't seem it on the surface. Seb, on one hand, players are there to play football and to win the World Cup, if they can, or go as far as they can. That's what the Dutch coach Louis van Gaal said on Thursday. He said, we're not going to demonstrate like Germany because we're here to be the world champions. And so you can't really blame them for taking a step back if the possibility of getting booked before they even kick off is real, can you?
You know, it's a tough one. We're all different. We all see things from a different angle. And I'm not even saying that they took a step back. There's some people, they might take a definite step back, but some of us, they don't take a step forward. That's a different story. There's some players, some nations, they take it at heart. The others, it doesn't mean that they don't care. It doesn't mean that, you know, it's not important for them, but they're not at the same place. So I'm not condemning anybody. I can't condemn anybody because we're all different. We all see things from different angles, and that's why I want to, you know, remind to people we can't always be the same. Otherwise, it wouldn't even be funny. But yeah, it's a tough one. We got to respect each other's mind, each other's view, and try to come to a middle ground. You know, to a happy medium to make sure that the football remains the priority. But at the end, we're all human beings, so we got to respect each other.
Pat, the decision by players like Harry Kane and other European nations not to wear the One Love armband because they were going to get booked. I mean, you know, the nature of protest, really effective protest, is to do it when there's something at risk to yourself, to stand up for your beliefs with that risk on the line, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, this subject we could spend the whole programme on, you know, and it is tempting to do that. First of all, I agree with Sebastian. You know, people are coming from different ideologies, different cultures, different religions, a lot of those things on top of each other. Do you know what I'd really like to make one point? And at the moment, FIFA and Qatar, they've said they don't want the armbands, right? The armbands worn, right? And do you know, if they'd have just turned a little blind eye and said, right, okay, wear them, it would have gone away. It hasn't. It's become a massive own goal. It's become something that's talked about all the time. So it's, you could say it's a terrible thing that the players aren't allowed to wear the armbands. That has got so much publicity. If you were working with a political party or something and you wanted to get publicity for your campaign, you would dream of this publicity. So it's kind of backfired massively. It is a real shame that it's become such a massive part of this cultural argument that we're having, but there is not a simple answer to it, because as you know, Manny, if you ask people in the Arab world towards this, they'll get a very, very different viewpoint. And what you'll get from when you get asked the question from the Western world, particularly Europeans, and I think it's still a discussion, and it still will be a discussion for a period of time, but it will partially fade just now because the football's on. And the one thing I would say, and I would underline this, I do not blame any footballer for either A, wearing, or B, not wearing. It's a personal choice, and that's a wonderful thing about freedom of speech.
Now, let's reflect on the shock results of the week, starting with the Japanese. This is the sound of Japanese fans in full voice. Their travelling supporters are known as the Ultra Nippon, and they're singing after that win against Germany. The German headline writers didn't hold back. The team's performance was described as a debacle, and the players were accused of making fools of themselves. And it could get worse. They're playing the rampant Spanish next on Sunday, hoping to avoid what happened in 2018 when they were knocked out of the group stage. For the Japanese, of course, it was a dream start, and I've been speaking to the veteran Japanese football journalist Kumi Kinohara.
To me, honestly saying, I was not expecting they could win. I thought they would manage to draw. But I was expecting, at the same time, they can do something well. And what made me surprised was the changes at the halftime, the drastic change from the four-back system to the three-back. Then that system was not really used in any official match. So I was kind of surprised to see that how well the players reacted to that changes, and did some good work throughout the last 45 minutes or plus more.
So many of these Japanese players play in Germany, of course. The fact that so many Japanese now play in Europe, do you think that their mentality has changed since 2018, when of course they lost to Belgium in a heartbreaking way with a goal in the final seconds of the game? This time they came back to beat Germany after being behind themselves.
Yes, definitely. And then that experience, a really bitter one back in 2018 against Belgium, that really helped them this time around. Because of that experience, they learned something that they have to be very careful, and they have to fight out through to the very last minute. So, and also the mental side, they were much stronger, and they feel themselves that they can be pretty much competitive against anyone, So that is also come from their training ground, at their own club or their regular league battles. So I think that was really good point, the good part that the Japanese football has established for the last few years.
So Costa Rica next, easy, right?
Easy? Well, that's something I don't know. But certainly, it's a positive aspect, for sure.
How will Japanese people back home be reacting to this? Will they be thinking, will they be thinking that it's all easy against Costa Rica? They lost 7-0. We're into the last 16 already, we just have to win the group? Or are they a bit more realistic about life in the World Cup?
I think they know what the World Cup is all about, and so they went really crazy yesterday, and I got lots of messages from my friends as well, and it kept ringing, and so did the players, and they received lots of messages, positive ones from their families and their friends back home. But the thing is, this is only one win, and it was a good start, but they also have to win the next one, otherwise, this means nothing. Because this is the seventh tournament playing in the World Cup, so the fans are also learning, and the players, they know what to do. And so I think that they are, getting pretty much realistic now.
Japanese journalist Kumi Kinohara speaking at the training ground the day after their great win. Seb Basong, Kumi Kinohara said that Japan have been playing with a four-man defence until Wednesday, when they switched to a three-man defence. How hard is it suddenly to change tactics like that?
Honestly, it takes courage, and I give them a lot of credit, because changing a formation like that throughout the game, when you haven't, as far as I'm aware, they haven't really experienced that tactic, many times before, it takes a lot, and it takes a lot of belief in the into the whole team, the whole squad, and the manager. Because sometimes, you know, players, they could question the manager's decision, but clearly that wasn't the case for the Japanese side. You know, the energy level for me was outstanding, and they kept on going physically. They're really in shape, and yeah, the fact that Germany wasn't at their best, you know, make things a little bit even. And they took their chance, so they deserve their win.
One line on top of that, Manny, just before we go away from it. Thank you for your information in this, because you told me about Ange Ball, Ange Postecoglou, and how his team's playing, and what he'd learned and what he'd done in Japan. So I've actually got... I was slightly ready for this, but only because you told me a long time ago.
Well, we're not leaving it just yet, Pat, because I want to ask you about Germany. Anyone who's seen them play this year, especially in their Nations League games, won't be surprised that they struggled to score. But were you surprised by the fact that they lost the lead and, in the end, lost the match?
In reality, it's now just a little surprise. I mean, have a look at when they got to the finals of the Euros. They lost to France. They drew with Hungary, they lost to some smaller team. Oh, sorry, it was England. And then, of course, you've got Japan. So, when you look at it now, you've got two wins out of eight at finals. And yet, this is now no longer a strange affair. This is getting to be the norm now. So, well done, Japan, for what they're doing. And I think we're getting to that area now. We're thinking, wait a minute, are some of the powerhouses, you know, Italy had the great Euros, but they obviously failed to get to the World Cup. The powerhouses, see if you chase them down. See if you show the energy. Can they keep going at your level? And it showed that the Germans weren't able to do it.
Sepp, some ex-German players have said for a long time that they don't have enough protection in front of the defence. Joshua Kimmich, Gundogan, Goretzka, great players, but none of them is a what's called in football a number six, a defensive midfielder. Do you think that played a part in it as well, that the defence wasn't protected that well?
It does play a part, especially when you know going throughout a good run, when you're not in the best shape or form of your life, especially if your defence is getting exposed. You know, you're going to get some waves after waves after wave, and if your two central defenders are not at their best, obviously it's going at some point it's going to be a problem. I think they're really lacking a real number six who can not move and protect those two central defenders, as a Khedira could have done before, or they used to have some strong central midfield. And in a team, that's very important, especially when you're not going through a good momentum.
Right, let's talk about some World Cup shocks then. In 1950, USA beat England. In 1966, North Korea beat Italy. South Korea beat Italy and Spain in 2002. Senegal also beat France that year. Don't worry, Seb, I haven't forgotten Cameroon beating Argentina in 1990. Some might say biggest.
That wasn't a shock. I don't know what you thought that was a shock. I don't even know what you're talking about. That was expected.
Some might say the biggest of all shocks is Scotland getting a draw against Iran in 1978. What about the Saudi Arabia result, Pat? And Seb, where does that fit into that list?
Well, first of all, I was at quite a few of those games that you mentioned, rather oddly. I was at
starting
the
with USA England.
Thank you very much. No, I wasn't born then, okay, before we go there. But the Senegal-France game, I was at that one. That was an amazing one. Both of the South Korea games that you mentioned, I was at both of those games as well. And they were incredible at the time. But it's sometimes these things happen just before you realise a team is becoming a powerhouse. If South Korea beat one of the major teams now, you wouldn't be shocked anymore. But it's just because of when it happened. But they are great moments. But I honestly think, barring North Korea beating the Italians in 66, I think this is right up there. I don't know if any of them beat this result, because it was the lack of expectation. Well, mostly from the Western world, let's be honest, that the Saudis could do that. But they did it with such a passion. Then there's some great players up front. And again, just what Seb says, the energy levels. They just couldn't live with them, could they?
I was impressed. I was in front of my TV. I was watching the game. They were giving me goosebumps, because honestly, they technically for me, they weren't that good, but they could have they balanced it out with their energy level, which was up to the roof. And they were just fighting for their life. For me, they overperformed. If you ask them to do that twice, I don't think they'll be able to do that again. But for that time in particular, honestly, well done. They were fighting, they were scrapping on every ball, and they made it count. And that's why Argentina players, they couldn't live with them.
Manny, could I ask you the question back? I mean, if you look at this part of the world, has there ever been a better result for a team from the Middle East, ever?
No. I mean, Saudi Arabia beat Belgium, of course, in 1994, but Belgium were a team well past their best, that squad. I mean, to beat Argentina and Messi and end their 36-match unbeaten run, by the way, I mean, that's and to come from behind as well to do it. You know, normally you would expect, you know, maybe they went 2-0 up, maybe it was 1-1, they scored a late goal and they hung on till the end. But it wasn't like that at all, was it, Pat?
And the joy, of course, one very, very good goal and one utterly brilliant goal. It was Messi, like, wasn't it?
It was a Messi goal. And even himself, I don't think he could even ever imagine. Because that's when you can tell the confidence was so high to bring that ball down and to go and take people on like that with that confidence and get his shots off top corner. Honestly, well done.
That is the magic of the World Cup. There are always, every World Cup has certain moments that are magical. There will be more in this World Cup, but there will have to go some to beat that moment that ball went in the top corner.
To be fair, Pat, if you don't do it now, when are you going to do it? When you're a Serbian player? Yeah. That's your chance. You got to take your chance. The crowd was amazing, was pushing, so you get uplifted. And this is when those moments become really, you know, memorable and unforgettable for them and for the whole football world.
Have you two been to Souk Waqif yet?
Oh, yeah, that's my favourite spot.
Well, some might say it's pretty much the only spot of interest in Doha. Some might say that. It's an area in central Doha that's become popular for football fans to hang out, with its maze of alleyways lined with shops piled high with dates, nuts, everyday items and handicraft. A couple of days after Argentina's loss to Saudi Arabia, once the dust had started to settle, we managed to get a word and these views from some travelling Argentina fans.
A little sad. Difficult because, you know, we lose the next game, we could be out. Which would suck, especially for such a big country, you know, with all the expectations that were expected. But we just got to forget about it and focus on Saturday. Win Saturday and then go with 2 finals now. That's it.
Everybody say it was an easy game, but till you got to play every game. So now it's a knockout. You got to win or go home.
Well, you know, shocking. That's for sure. But, you know, I think we need to turn the page and focus on Saturday's game. And if we take a win on that, everything is going to change mentally for the team. So hopefully we can beat Mexico.
Yeah, Mexico and Poland, the next group games for Argentina. I don't know if either of you saw Mexico play Poland, but, I mean, I don't want to say this because some Argentinian fans must have thought this before Saudi Arabia, but do you think they've really got anything to worry about in terms of playing those two?
I stayed awake for most of it. there was parts of the game which were... And you're always going to get that at a World Cup. There's going to be games, especially if you're a bit tentative. There's a big thing, a draw in your first game is not always, it's quite often okay, but a loss in your first game and you're up against the eight ball, and it's a really, really tough, because it changes everything when you lose the first game. But they're both very decent technical sides, and Argentina, they've got weaknesses. I mean, we know in recent World Cups, and even with Messi there, there are weaknesses, and it's almost like a mental thing. I think we all think that now, don't we? There's a mental thing with the Argentinians. You look around the team and you think, yeah, real quality there. And then does anyone think they're going to win? Well, usually not that many. And I have to say, they'll do well to get out of this group now. I think they might just scrape out, but it's not going to be easy.
No, it's not going to be that easy. But Pat nailed down something very interesting, is the mental side of it. you know, even though they got Messi, and as far as I'm aware, they're all playing for him because they really want him to get his, you know, silverware, get the World Cup. So they might not play the way they should be playing because of that, because they really want him to win. And at the moment, you know, the fact that they lost the first game, they're going to be stressed a little bit, a lot. And it's going to be a kind of, a, not a derby, but a South American derby. It's Mexico against Argentina. It's always, you know, a different taste. So I don't think it's going to be an easy one for the Argentinian people. But, I know, I vouch for Messi anyway.
Let's go deep with our analysis of Saudi Arabia. Hervé Renard's white shirt. He loves the white shirt. It's his lucky colour. Hopefully he's got more than one, because he always wears one. When you two were playing in big games, did you have any lucky apparel that you used to put on?
Well, I don't do that sort of thing, but I thought about this long and hard. And I'll be honest with you, see, when I had a pair of football boots that I liked, and I at the time I was sponsored by Puma, I would wear them even though there was big holes in the front of them. And the other thing I always did, I always soaked my boots in boiling water before I played and put them on, and they moulded to your feet. You know, these days, the modern boots all mould to your feet anyway. But back then, you know, that's something that I did. But I don't think that was, I think that was just being professional.
Yeah, in terms of superstition, you know, we're from Africa. We've got superstition all over the place. You know, as soon as something worked, you think that, I don't know, I've walked on the pitch in a certain way, and you think, oh, I've had a good game. Until you have a bad game, that's going to be your next superstition. But I think superstition fades away with experience. When you're young, you're looking for something to attach yourself emotionally, something that gives you reassurance. So Hervé Renard, I think it's also a branding thing. You know, that's his brand. He's been known to be the white, you know, the white wizard with a white shirt. So that's kind of his brand, and I think that works well for him. But that's not a superstition for me anymore.
Qatar, like most of the Middle East, features head-on collisions between the old and the modern. This is the sound of the call to prayer being broadcast in the Mall of Qatar. While the muezzin tells the people to get in touch with their God, hundreds of shops are trying to get them to make contact with their wallets. The first ever World Cup in the Muslim world is, of course, highly significant for Islamic players like Yunus Musa. He was born in New York to Ghanaian parents, and after spending years in the English football youth system, will face England for the USA on Friday. He's 19 and at his debut World Cup, and he's enjoying the spiritual side of the tournament as well as the soccer one.
Yeah, that's huge. From when they said that it was going to be in Qatar, and we qualified, thought about that, because I've always wanted to come and experience living in a Muslim country where there's a mosque everywhere. You know, most of the population is Muslim, and you just, everything's halal, and you're able to practice your religion really well. And I'm enjoying it. I really like it. For example, I was out in a shopping center, and it was time to pray, and I could just go to the mosque right opposite the shop to pray. That's a key thing in religion, to be able to pray on time, things like that. And I was able to do that.
How often do you pray?
Yeah, 5 times a day.
Do you?
Yeah.
Let's talk about your switch. You grew up in the England youth ranks and at Arsenal, but last March finally decided to play for the USA.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, you had a sort of taster camp with the squad. What was that like? How do you remember that?
Yeah, so that November camp, my first, like 2 years ago, I just wanted to go in and see how it was, no pressure. And it turned out to be a camp that showed me that I wanted to play for these guys and this manager and this nation. Here I am today, so it's been a great journey from the day that Greg spoke to me, telling me about how we could one day get to the World Cup and hopefully if I play well and, you know, things like that. And it's a nice feeling to finally be here.
What was it about that camp in particular that convinced you to switch?
With England, obviously, I had a great time. Nothing to complain about. I had amazing camps, played for a lot of the youth teams. So, no, that was an amazing experience. And then it came to a point where I had to make a decision for my professional career, first team level, and I was at that age, young age, and I had an opportunity with the US and with a great team. And that camp, I just had a great feeling. People were really welcoming. The teammates were great. We had a great bond on the pitch. And I made that decision after that.
While you were with the England youth teams, did you ever meet Gareth Southgate? Because it is quite joined up, isn't it? The youth teams are connected to the senior team.
Never spoke one-on-one, but we did have a talk about him, yeah, as a team, you know. No, it was great to have the England manager speak to you at the time, like hoping one day, you know, he'll get selected by him.
At Arsenal, you were there for 7 years in the youth ranks. How do you look back on that time?
I had a great time at Arsenal for the years I was there. Great coaches, great teammates. So that was like a key time for me to develop. I learned so many details that helped me in the game, like till now. And I feel like as a player in those years, I grew so much. Because of how good they are as an academy. Like, you all know how many players they produce. So, yeah, I could have never been where I am without that help, really.
Have you kept in touch with any of your former Arsenal teammates in the youth ranks, some of whom, like Bukayo Saka, are now full internationals like you? Has there been any banter since the draw through the USA and England together in the same group?
Yeah. They were shocked when they saw the news and... Like, it's crazy how you used to play for them and now you have to play against them, things like that, you know. And yeah, for me as well, to play against, hopefully, Jude Bellingham, Bukayo, I played with them before, so that would be a special moment to share the field with them, you know.
Tell me about some of the sacrifices that your family has had to make so that you can get to where you are today, here at the World Cup.
I'd say more sacrifices, yeah, it was probably for my parents. You know, the whole migration process from Ghana till now, they sacrificed so much for us to, you know, first of all, have a good life. My dad, for example, left Ghana when he was really young, younger than me, to look for a better life. Went through so many different countries, right, to find work and just be able to grow in his life and be able to settle down, right? So that ended up happening well in Italy after a lot of struggle, of course. Now, can't believe it that his son is going to play in the World Cup and he's living in a good place in London and things like that.
With such a rich background, how would you define your identity?
I've been asked that question a lot and I don't like to identify myself as just being part of one country because I've grown up in different countries and every country that I've been in, I've been there for a while and had a good time and met a lot of people and I feel part of all of those.
Do you think that being at the World Cup is a kind of thank you to your parents?
Yeah. When I got selected, they were over the moon and really joyful about it. And as you said, this is a bit of like a very happy moment for them and for me as well after everything that's happened.
That's the USA midfielder Yunus Musa, and what a great talker he is at the age of 19. Pat, what's going on outside? It's very noisy where you are. We don't like all this rowdiness on world football.
Do you know what? I thought they were going to come into the room at one point. It's mobbed down there. There are so many people. And it's Qatari people. They're having some sort of procession. I will admit to you that my local language knowledge is limited, so I'm not too sure what they're singing. But it's great to see that. There's a real bit of passion down there. And maybe that was the thing. I was at the first game. I wasn't seeing that passion that night. But it's out there. So if it's anything got to do with football that they're singing about, then expect a more noisy game for the Qataris, the next game to play.
You've been there for a week and you're not fluent in Arabic. What have you been doing?
Do you know, and the lovely thing is the laziness of the Brits. Everyone's English here is perfect. And that is the thing, is everyone I've spoken to, you know, they fluently talk. And what is even more impressive, they seem to understand my accent. And that's impressive. Well, that's really got to me. So
they're just being polite.
just the correct nodding. Answer to that is, what? Pardon?
Seb, let's go back to Yunus Musa, because it gives us the perfect opportunity to plug a World Service documentary featuring you that's online right now, called Which Country Should I Play For? It's all about players of dual heritage making the difficult decision to choose which country they play for. funnily enough. Tell us about your decision to play for Cameroon instead of France. Whet the appetite. Give this. That's the perfect advert for this documentary. It's a great story as well.
Yeah, it's a great story in terms of, first and foremost, because I choose Cameroon really at a really young age. I choose Cameroon when I was turning 20. I had the opportunity to play for France because the French national team manager called me. But honestly, I was torn apart. And I asked my dad, what shall I do? And my dad being who he is, I was expecting him to give me a straight answer and an order, because that's how it is. But he surprisingly told me, listen, I can't decide for you, but he told me to do something, and after that, I'll have my answer, which was listen to two different national anthems and see how you feel about them. And that's what I did. And because I grew up in France, but in my house, it was Cameroon. I was in France, but everything was Cameroonian, honestly, from start to finish. But I owe a lot to France. So that's why it was a bit difficult, because I played for France under 21, and for me, I was proud. But yeah, at some point, I wanted to make a choice really early, and when I was not at the peak of my career, but I had the real choice. It wasn't a choice by default, because France offered me to play for France, but I made the conscious decision to play for Cameroon, and since that, I don't regret anything from that.
Pat, you, of course, were an England international and switched to Scotland. What was the thinking there?
That's harsh. No, actually, I did have the choice. I had the choice between the Republic of Ireland or Scotland. Indeed, I have an Irish passport as well as a British one. And my father would have wanted me to play for Ireland, because that's the background of my family, but I felt very much Scottish. So, yes, to the listener who doesn't know, I did once have to play for England. I had to pull on the three lines at Wembley against some bloke called Maradona and somebody called Platini. But as I often say, I promise you, it wasn't the most embarrassing moment of my career. Just close to it. My friends have never let me forget that I wore the England shirt.
So, Seb, if France played Cameroon, who are you supporting?
Cameroon all the way.
We didn't have to wait there, did we?
No, we didn't.
Cameroon, 110%.
There's no.
We asked this question of Manny about Iran versus England. And that was a very quick answer. Yeah. But you've not really talked about that game much since, have
no,
you?
No, no. We'll draw a line under that. Perhaps in 20 years' time or something. Now then, Qatar is full of delicious cuisines, especially from Lebanon and the wider Middle East area. I hope you've been eating well, both of you, because, you know, the World Cup, there's a lot happening in the World Cup, four games a day. Have you tried the spiced dish of Qatar, Machbous, yet?
Well, I haven't, but I will, after this programme, be going straight to a restaurant and doing that if you tell me to do that. The problem is here, Manny, we're working quite hard. You know, every day there's a game every single day, and you're travelling, getting there. You have to get very early to the games. Would you believe, for the first game, we were told to turn up 6 hours before the start of the game, and I've never heard anything like it in my life. So basically, eating whatever we can. So I will try that today.
I have, honestly.
You have.
I enjoy my life. Oh, of course. I have. I give myself some time to eat, to feed myself. You know, I'm a big bloke, yeah. So I need to refuel. But no, the food over here is amazing, and I advise you guys to try everything you can. You're never gonna regret it.
Pat, you're a trooper, aren't you? You know, watching a football match every day, not easy.
I know. But get the violence out.
Yeah, you're doing it. Right, that's the end of the programme. Of course, if this was a World Cup match, we'd go on for another 15 minutes, but we can't. So we'll draw a line there and remind you that our next extra World Cup pod drops on Friday, and there's one on Sunday and Tuesday, and just so much from us at the World Cup. Enjoy those, and Pat and I will speak to you again next Thursday, if not before. Until then, from Pat, Seb and me, goodbye.
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 World Football in Qatar is a BBC Sport production for the BBC World Service.